and welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for March 12, 2015 on WPFW Washington 89.3, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Avaram, joined later in the studio by Lucy Murphy. So what's up with President Obama declaring Venezuela to be a threat to the national security of the United States? We'll talk to Arturo Vizcarra of School of America's Watch, hear a program produced by Hands Off Venezuela, and Lucy will take your calls in the second half of the show. Of course, we have a jam-packed show starting with our headlines. In news that broke last night, the police chief of Ferguson, Missouri, Thomas Jackson, has resigned. The resignation comes in the aftermath of the Department of Justice report that found the city of Ferguson routinely violated constitutional rights, disproportionately targeted blacks, and was rife with racism. Also in Ferguson, the city manager, municipal judge, top court clerk, and two police supervisors have stepped down in the wake of the report's release last week. Attorneys for the family of Michael Brown have announced plans to sue the city of Ferguson, Missouri, and Darren Wilson, the police officer who shot and killed the unarmed African-American teenager. Attorney Anthony Gray made the announcement a day after the Justice Department said it would not bring civil rights charges against Wilson.
And we've always felt from the very beginning that Officer Darren Wilson did not have to shoot and kill Mike Brown Jr. in broad daylight in the manner that he did, that he had other options available to him, and that he chose deadly force as his option. And we plan to demonstrate in a court of law to reasonable-minded people that the choice to use deadly force was unreasonable and unnecessary under those circumstances.
In Wisconsin, high school and college students packed the state capitol Monday in the fourth day of protests over the killing of unarmed black teenager Tony Robinson. Police say Robinson was shot and killed in an apartment after Officer Matt Kenny responded to a report of a man jumping in and out of traffic after assaulting someone. Some 1,500 students filled the capitol rotunda, hanging a banner that read, "Black Lives Matter." In environmental news, North Carolina has fined the utility giant Duke Energy $25.1 million, the largest environmental fine in state history. The penalty concerns groundwater contamination from a coal ash plant near Wilmington. It is separate from a pending fine at the federal level for Duke's spill of more than 35 million gallons of coal ash into the Dan River, one of the worst such spills in U.S. history. Officials in Florida have reportedly banned the terms climate change and global warming, despite the disproportionate impacts of climate change in the coastal state. According to the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, under the tenure of Republican Governor Rick Scott, officials at the Department of Environmental Protection have been ordered not to refer to climate change or global warming in official reports or communications. Think Progress notes at least two other states, North Carolina and Pennsylvania, have been accused of similar bans. Here in D.C., Spring Rising is 4 days of creative resistance, theater, teach-ins, rallies, and marches marking the anniversary of the United States' shock and awe attack on Iraq and its invasion and occupation. Spring Rising opposes war and the violence and oppression of empire at home and abroad. The 4 days start on Wednesday, March 18th, 5 to 8 p.m. at Plymouth Congregational Church, 5301 North Capitol Street in Northeast. Anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan posted this information about Spring Rising.
This is Cindy Sheehan, your hippy-dippy peacenik, with an important and exciting announcement. But first, this message from me and the Soapbox People's Network. As should be glaringly obvious, the United States of America, as a whole, is lovingly devoted to its wars. In school, we learn the history of this empire from war to shining war, and the history of the USA's expansion is one of genocide and slavery cloaked in a holy manifest from God. To wit, war reenactments are very popular with a certain subset of our culture, a culture that not only worships war, but wants to be part, at least pretend to be part, of the glorious wars whose evil karma have combined to get us to this point. War is our religion, and Obama is nothing but the current high priest of this cult. The same people who opposed war during the Bush regime support war during the Obama regime. And those that supported war during the Bush regime think Obama needs to ritually bathe in even more blood. So obviously, again, most people in the United States aren't actually anti-war and are definitely not anti-empire. Even though the recent climate march in NYC was a success, if one counts success not by efficacy but by numbers, we who still remain in the peace movement feel lucky if we can pull in 100 to our demos opposing the bloody hand of empire. To this end, the Soapbox People's Network is sponsoring an anti-war reenactment in Washington, D.C., and we believe this is the first ever anti-war reenactment in history. The sneaky thing is, though, we will perform exciting reenactments of anti-Vietnam War protests and teach-ins and sit-ins, etc., and we hope we get thousands and everyone dresses up in their best 60s and 70s gear. We will really be demanding an end to war and empire. Bottom line, if you are a supporter of Obama's foreign policy, leaving aside his disastrous domestic issues for a second, you are a supporter of Murder, Inc. and empire. I know most of you don't really support these policies, but for some weird reason think you need to circle the wagons around the first black president trademark, who is just as vigorously an able servant of empire trademark as the 43 white guys before him. Quote, humanitarian intervention trademark, end quote, is not only an oxymoron, but a big propagandistic myth to get you to support murder and mayhem from a D for Democrat. We need the numbers to demonstrate to this war machine that we care more about the people they bomb than the two-party scam they have been running for decades now. We are in the very beginning stages of organizing, but if you would like to help in any way, please email Dee Dee Miller, dd4peace@gmail.com. That's Dee Dee, the number 4, peace@gmail.com. D-E-D-E, 4peace@gmail.com. We will need to raise money, have ride sharing, housing, materials, PR, organizers, and don't even come thinking we're going to get permits, because we believe our Bill of Rights is the only permit we need to exercise those rights. So dust off your love beads and polish up your VW van and plan on joining us for all or part of our weekend of love for humanity. Stay tuned for more info. Peace, love, and revolution.
Look over yonder. What do you see?
For more information, go to springrising.org or contact Dee Dee at dd4peace@gmail.com. That's D-E-D-E 4, the number 4, peace@gmail.com. Also on March 18th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Plymouth Congregational Church, U.S. Secretary of Labor Tom Perez, economist Julianne Malveaux, and the Reverend Graylin Hagler will meet with D.C. home care workers in a town hall meeting. D.C. home care workers are joining with workers around the country for quality care and to reform the home care industry. For more information, call 1-800-956-8918 or go to wecarefordc.org. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, what is really happening in Venezuela? Stay with us.
I am going back to Brazil.
Ta, 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 ta.
I can't stay in a place that is making me ill.
Ta, 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 ta.
The pressures of life put a screw on my face. Afraid to recall what's going on in this place. In this town, somebody get gunned down. You ain't see crimes getting weaker now. TNT and you are gone. What else to do? We gone through like you want me record for you. Every day on the hill, two or three does get killed. Do we recall that? Do we recall? Down.
Do we recall that?
Do we recall that? And Archie and company telling me don't worry, things are rough.
That was Heather McIntosh on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam. Well, when President Obama declared Venezuela to be a threat to the national security of the United States, Mark Wiesbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, was one of the people who considered it a step toward the theater of the absurd. Who do they think they are kidding? Wiesbrot asks in his syndicated column. He continues, some may say that the language is just there because it is necessary under U.S. law in order to impose the latest round of sanctions on Venezuela. That is not much of a defense. Telling the whole world the rule of law in the United States is something the president can use lies to get around whenever he finds it inconvenient. That was the approach of President Ronald Reagan in 1985 when he made a similar declaration in order to impose sanctions, including an economic embargo on Nicaragua. Like the White House today, he was trying to topple an elected government that Washington didn't like. He was able to use paramilitary and terrorist violence, as well as an embargo in a successful effort to destroy the Nicaraguan economy and ultimately overturn its government. The Sandinistas eventually returned to power in 2007 and are the governing party today. The world has moved forward, even though Washington has not, Wiesbrot says. Venezuela today has very strong backing from its neighbors against what almost every government in the region sees as an attempt to destabilize the country. The Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC, reiterates its strong repudiation of the application of unilateral coercive measures that are contrary to international law, read a statement from every country in the hemisphere except for the U.S. and Canada on February 11th. They were responding to the U.S. sanctions against Venezuela that Obama signed into law in December. Didn't read any of this in the English language media? Well, you probably also didn't see the immediate reaction to the White House recent blunder from the head of the Union of South American Nations, which read, UNASUR rejects any external or internal attempt at interference that seeks to disrupt the democratic process in Venezuela. The Obama administration is more isolated today in Latin America than even George W. Bush's administration was. Washington was involved in the short-lived 2002 military coup in Venezuela. It, quote, provided training, institution building, and other support to individuals and organizations understood to be actively involved in the brief ouster, end quote, of President Hugo Chavez and his government, according to the U.S. State Department. The U.S. has not changed its policy toward Venezuela since then and has continued funding opposition groups in the country. So it is only natural that everyone familiar with this recent history, with a conflict between the U.S. and the region over the 2009 Honduran military coup, and with the current sanctions, will assume that Washington is involved in the ongoing efforts to topple what has been its number one or two target for regime change for more than a decade. The Venezuelan government has produced some credible evidence of a coup in the making, the recording of a former deputy minister of the interior reading what is obviously a communique to be issued after the military deposes the elected government, the confessions of some accused military officers, and a recorded phone conversation between opposition leaders acknowledging that a coup is in the works. Regardless of whether one thinks this evidence is sufficient, the U.S. press has not reported most of it, it is little wonder that the governments in the region are convinced. Efforts to overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuela have been underway for most of the past 15 years. Why would it be any different now, when the economy is in recession and there was an effort to force out the government just last year? And has anyone ever seen an attempted ouster of a leftist government in Latin America that Washington had nothing to do with? Because I haven't, he says kind of sarcastically. In the major U.S. and international media, we see that Obama has taken a historic step by beginning the process of normalizing relations with Cuba. But among Latin American governments, this sliver of restored credibility that this move has won has been swiftly negated by the aggression toward Venezuela. You will be hard-pressed to find a foreign minister or president from the region who believes that U.S. sanctions have anything to do with human rights or democracy. Look at Mexico, where human rights workers and journalists are regularly murdered, or Colombia, which has been a leader for years in the number of trade unionists killed. Nothing comparable to these human rights nightmares has happened in Venezuela in 16 years under Chavez or current President Nicolas Maduro. Yet Mexico and Colombia have been among the largest recipients of U.S. aid in the region, including military and police funding and weapons. The Obama administration is more isolated today in Latin America than even George Bush's administration was, because of the wide gulf between the major international media and the thinking of regional governments. This is not obvious to those who are unfamiliar with the details of hemispheric relations. Look at who co-authored the legislation that imposed sanctions against Venezuela in December. Soon to be indicted Senator Robert Menendez and Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio, both ardent defenders of the embargo against Cuba. Yet the administration proudly announced that its new sanctions go beyond the requirements of this legislation. The face of Washington in Latin America is one of extremism. Despite some changes in other areas of foreign policy, for example, Obama's engagement with Iran, this face has not changed very much since Reagan warned us that Nicaragua's Sandinistas were just 2 days driving time from Arlington, Texas. He was ridiculed by Gary Trudeau in Doonesbury and other satirists. The Obama White House's Reagan Redux should get the same treatment. Those were the words of Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and those are the words from his syndicated column. Now, on the ground was at the Venezuelan embassy recently for a program commemorating the one-year anniversary of the Guarimbas, violent protests by government opponents. And this is a soundtrack from a video completed by the Hands Off Venezuela Coalition when the violence was at its height last year.
What's really going on in Venezuela? On January the 23rd, Leopoldo López and Maria Corina Machado publicly declared their intention to oust President Nicolas Maduro and his government. They called the plan La Salida, the exit.
Porque lo siguiente es prender las calles de lucha cívica y responsable. Si estamos a prender las calles de Venezuela, todos los rincones, los mercados, las escuelas, las universidades.
Over the following days, these two opposition leaders and their political party, Voluntad Popular, Popular Will, held public meetings in the main cities around the country. Their slogan was, "It's time to talk about a change of government." On the 2nd of February, in a public demonstration in Caracas, they activated the ousting by calling on people to take to the streets of Venezuela.
Aquí el problema, hermanas y hermanos, ya no podemos decir que solamente es Nicolás Maduro, no. Aquí el problema son todos los poderes públicos del poder nacional. La calle, 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 salgamos a la calle.
On the 6th of February, groups of students, mainly from Los Andes University, attacked the house of the governor of Táchira State. 6 policemen were injured and 12 students were arrested during the violent scenes. The students were freed on the 13th of February and ordered to report to court every 8 days. Following their arrests, violent acts became commonplace in Táchira State and other states of the Venezuelan Andes region. On the 7th of February, just 1 day after the violence in Táchira, Leopoldo López called for massive demonstrations to take place across Venezuela and especially in Caracas. The day selected was the 12th of February, Venezuela's National Youth Day. Whilst thousands of students and young people marched to support the government, opposition protesters destroyed private and public property in Caracas and other cities. 3 people were killed during the violence that day, 2 students and 1 government supporter. This is what's really going on in Venezuela. An extremist minority of violent opposition members have blocked roads, attacked public and private buildings, and set fire to police cars. Looting has also been reported. This minority carries homemade guns, Molotov cocktails, rocks and other weapons. They hide their faces with masks and t-shirts. Whilst they claim they just want peace, every single day they demonstrate through their actions that they're not so peaceful after all. The police and National Guard have confronted this minority, who have attacked and injured public servants. ...36 Caracas metro workers have been attacked and injured. 40 metrobuses have been attacked with stones whilst they carried passengers. In total, 200 people have received medical treatment so far for injuries during attacks on public transport. The state TV channel VTV has been besieged and under attack with stones and Molotov cocktails every night since February the 12th. To date, 18 Venezuelans have died, with victims on both sides. 261 have been injured. This is the terrible consequence of an orchestrated plan by opposition leaders trying to oust a legitimate government. The Venezuelan government has been informing people about the victims in arrest since day one. So far, 712 people have been detained, both opposition and pro-government supporters. Just 55 remain in prison. 11 members of the security services have also been arrested due to their actions during the violence. He is not a political prisoner. With an opposition leader who organized and incited violence in order to oust their legitimate governments. The majority of the newspapers, radio stations and TV channels in Venezuela are in private hands. The state controls a minority share of the media. The private media, both within and outside Venezuela, has been promoting a distorted view of what is happening. The opposition protesters have claimed that they have no freedom of speech. But this is contradicted by the 24-hour news channels, radio stations and newspapers who solely express their viewpoint. The government is silenced by these media outlets. Instead, there is a campaign in the international and social media of Maduro. False information and a torture of detainees has been actually taken in other countries, which have been shared widely on Twitter and in the international media without having been verified. Why is Venezuela under attack? The Bolivarian government, which has been in power since the victory of Hugo Chavez in the presidential election of 1998, has since won 19 elections in the last 15 years. All of which have been declared free and fair by international observers. Venezuela has the largest oil reserves and the 8th largest proven gas reserves in the world. The income from these natural resources has been used to benefit the majority of the people through a range of social programs which have tackled poverty and brought free healthcare and education. Over the last few weeks, we have seen an attempt to oust the legitimate government of Nicolas Maduro, who was elected on 14th of April 2013 in an election internationally recognized as free and fair. During 2013, Venezuela's opposition suffered defeats in both the presidential and the local authority elections. Faced with this situation, extremist elements have unleashed a desperate campaign to seize power. Venezuelans are being used as cannon fodder by extreme sectors of the opposition. This is what's really going on in Venezuela. The government is confronting these anti-democratic movements and trying to restore peace for all Venezuelans. The majority of Venezuelans do not want to see any more deaths. If you're a Venezuelan, please share this video. If you're a friend of Venezuela, please share this video. If you want to spread the truth, please share this video. If you believe in democracy and social progress, please share this video. Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition on WPFW 89.3, Washington, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. And you just heard sound from What is Really Happening in Venezuela, a video produced last year by the Hands Off Venezuela Coalition that is fitting to mark the anniversary of the orchestrated violence in that country that attempted a regime change. And also fitting as we discuss President Obama declaring Venezuela to be a threat to the national security of the United States. When we come back, Lucy Murphy will continue the conversation with Arturo Vizcarra, human rights activist and attorney who is advocacy coordinator for the School of America's Watch. You can join the discussion by calling 202-588-0893. That'll be the number to call. Stay with us.
Just say he crazy. Delusional fool. They say he's selfish and want things my way. I say they're lazy, they're too nonchalant and cool. His cause is bigger than just a highway. They're calling him fraud. Say he cannot be of God. And whether he die or not, it don't matter. But what they don't see is a man who'll die for country. I'll call him a patriot and martyr. Dr. Kublai Singh took a stand against corruption. Then they say, I say, life is too precious for that. They say, surely he must have had a better option. Dating, we all willing to die. Hey. Tell me for what and why. Hey. For something noble or just to get a lie.
Are you willing to die?
Just for some nicotine. You're smoking cigarettes by the pack. Ah, boy.
Are you willing to die?
Just for the thrill of speed.
Are you willing
the highway
to die?
Is your progress track.
Are you willing to die?
Just for sexual antics.
Are you willing
risking
to
AIDS
die?
And HIV.
Are you willing to die?
Like Dr. Kublai Singh. No water, no food,
die?
Not even IV. Oh, what
are
you willing to die for? Tell me, what you will lose your life for? Will you die for your country? Trinidad, come! Will you die for your country? Hear me, now! A legal pillar who stood for justice and truth. Senior counsel and lead prosecutor. Some coward killers, now almost 1 year removed. Up to now they still can't find that shooter. Justice reform on her plate, high profile case for the state.
That was Joanna Tigress Rowley on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment. On the Ground edition on WPFW Washington 89.3, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I'm Lucy Murphy, and for this next segment, I'm joined on the line by Arturo Biscarra, human rights activist and attorney, who is advocacy coordinator for School of America's Watch. 202-588-0893 is the number to call to join the conversation. What are your comments on the declaration by President Obama that Venezuela is a threat to the national security of the United States? Welcome, Arturo.
Yes, hi, Lucy.
Let's start with your reaction to this declaration by President Obama.
Well, obviously, it's just on its face, it's a very ridiculous assertion that Venezuela represents any type of national security threat to the United States. It obviously is must be seen in the lens of 15 years of aggression and intervention by the U.S., including a coup d'état that occurred in 2002. Ever since the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998, the U.S. has had a very belligerent position towards Venezuela, and unfortunately we're seeing just basically a continuation of that, and more so an escalation, and I think it also should be considered in light of the all the praise that Obama has received for not really having even done anything yet, but just announcing a supposed opening with Cuba, and the very next day the sanctions are passed. And finally they were announced a couple of days ago, and it was a little, I think, even shocking for those of us that have been following the issue for them to be as extreme as they are, because they really are, they're farcical. They don't reflect, reality.
You know, looking at them, I was reminded about the sanctions that were brought against Nicaragua back in the 80s. And unfortunately, the Sandinistas were forced out at that time. I was wondering if you would like to comment on the difference between, sanctions against Nicaragua and sanctions against Venezuela.
Well, we really hope that they wouldn't turn into, you know, looking at anything similar to what Nicaraguan sanctions look like. The sanctions in Nicaragua, allowed the U.S. to basically it gave them more leeway to continue funding their proxy army, the CIA proxy army known as the Contras, who were basically just thugs and terrorists that were really more concerned with terrorizing the civilian population than even trying to engage the military of Nicaragua in armed battle. So what one concern would be here? Oh, also the sanctions. Also, one of the other things that the U.S. used to be able to mine the harbors of Nicaragua, which was later a court case that in the international court that Nicaragua would go on to win, but the U.S. Packed up its toys and went home and withdrew from the international court before that could be enforced. But at least domestically, provided the U.S. the capability to take those types of warlike actions, without actually sending in troops. So, on the extreme level, we really hope that doesn't, end up happening, but it is concerning to see that the language in this, in these sanctions bills against Venezuela, presumably would be able to be justified by U.S. administrations to arm and fund armed opposition groups, or more brazenly try to destabilize or topple the government. So it's very concerning, but we'll see what happens. But the language is definitely there. It's potentially, also, I've seen some analysis from some National Lawyers Guild attorneys. The way that they're set up, these sanctions, is the way it's written, they also potentially criminalize solidarity with Venezuela, travel to Venezuela, spending your money in Venezuela. It's very scary, and it's an assault on our own constitutional rights here in the United States, and I think that's something that the public here, including liberals, should be very concerned about.
I think it's interesting. Venezuela still supplies this country, what is it, the fourth largest supplier of oil?
I think it's around there, yes.
And just contrasting the two countries, say Nicaragua and Venezuela, of course Venezuela has a lot more resources, much wealthier country, and we hope that they are able to resist these assaults. I know in Nicaragua the Contras were bombing clinics.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you've already seen similar tactics from the Venezuelan opposition. I think it's also important to go back and really even also re-examine just even the justification for these sanctions. The justification for these sanctions isn't even anything that has to do with what's going on in Venezuela right now, even though that's what the State Department and the major mainstream media would have you believe. If you read the New York Times or the Washington Post on this issue, it seems like there's an incredible amount of turmoil going on in Venezuela at the moment. What's going on in Venezuela at the moment is definitely a tense political climate, but there's not protest happening, mass protests, because the opposition is also divided. They are rotten and violent to the core, and they also can't agree on any strategies, even with the help of the constant help and tutelage of the U.S. State Department and other organizations. But they there's not a lot of protests going on right now. So the protests, the killing of any protesters that the U.S. supposedly saying that it clamped down on happened a year ago. And at the end of the day, we're talking about roughly, five people that were killed by security agents, who were subsequently, arrested. So there's not even impunity going on for the killing of these people, like there is in the U.S. on a daily basis with the killing of unarmed or armed or whatever of innocent people.
Unarmed young black men.
Yes, every single day, and we're talking about protests. People are killed in protests all over the world, It's obviously unfortunate. There's nobody saying that there should be an excuse to that. But Venezuela has actually arrested the few officers that were involved in these few killings. And out of the total of around 40 killings last year during these protests, more than half of those were committed by the opposition, including killing six National Guards of Venezuela. So you have to take that into perspective. In the U.S., if the type of violent protests occurred that were happening in Venezuela, because there was actually, this was nonviolent protest, they weren't nonviolent protests all of the time, the body count would be much, much higher. And I think that's just, it's just really ridiculous. It's obviously politically motivated, and I think the rest of the world quickly recognizes that, that hypocrisy, and definitely Latin America does.
Then, I mean, if we look at the region, right next door in Colombia, which is, has seen much more violence against, trade unionists and community organizers, Venezuela's actually been playing a role of peacemaker.
Correct. I mean, yeah, Venezuela has been for a very long, you know, under the presidency of Hugo Chavez, continuing under the presidency of Maduro. It's a complicated relationship between Venezuela and Colombia, but they share, you know, very, very long border, and they share a lot of cultural and familial relationships, a lot of economic relationships. But they've been trying to play a positive role in the peace process for a long time now, something that the U.S. has, you know, has definitely been annoyed about for over the last 8 years or so. So that's one thing. But what is happening in Colombia is really, you know, since 2000, the U.S. starts playing Colombia there. Not only is it just a huge, the number one, the murder capital of trade unionists, but it's a country has the highest amount of internally displaced people, outside of, I think it's number two after Syria at this point, just because there's so many, it's a long-standing struggle of a civil war of over 50 years. But there's still millions of people that are internally displaced, that are refugees in Venezuela, in Ecuador. And there's also the killing of over at least 6,000 civilians, innocent people that were killed by the Colombian military and then dressed up as guerrillas, and counted as enemy kills. This was all done under the tutelage of U.S. foreign military training at the School of the Americas and at other, institutions.
So it seems we reward them rather than sanction them.
Exactly. I think that's another reason why these sanctions are so laughable. U.S. allies, right-wing allies, most notably Colombia, Mexico, and Honduras, the horrors that occur there on a daily basis, make anything that's happening in Venezuela pale in comparison.
I want you to talk a little bit about Mexico, but we are being joined by a caller. Caller, would you give your name?
My name is Tasta. Good morning.
Good morning.
It is the responsibility of the citizens of the United States to weigh the situation and decide whether Venezuela is a national security problem to the United States. But there is something confusing. For example, the Ethiopian government is not elected and it has not held any elections in its lifetime of 24 years so far,
viewed as an ally of the U.S. government, is it not?
Yes.
Thank you very much. We ask people to refrain from calling more than once to the station to give other people an opportunity to share. Arturo, I know that you have been following the goings on in Ayotzinapa, which in Mexico. We were talking about Colombia, but certainly there's a lot of violence in Mexico. And if you would comment about that and a program that you're working on coming up this spring.
Yes. Again, this is also another extremely, obviously, Colombia is a natural comparison with Venezuela, given its that they're neighbors. And yeah, there's definitely ongoing human rights violations happening on the Colombia for now for over 15 years. That with the help of, with the escalation of U.S. assistance, but Mexico is also, an incredibly telling, comparison. The war on drugs has been going on, now for many years. If you count from when President Nixon declared it, but in Mexico, it's definitely been an issue for a long time, and also including just the contradictions, hypocrisies, and other problems with U.S. involvement in the war on drugs. Since 2006, though, there's been a very marked escalation, militarization of the drug war in Mexico, and since then, over 100,000 people have lost their lives. 100,000 people. And also, at least, it's over 30,000 people have been disappeared. And not to mention just all sorts of other types of human rights violations. Most of these, a lot of these violations are attributed to non-state actors, to narco cartels. But the reality is that the cartels are actually part of, work hand in hand with the Mexican security forces. And then the Mexican security forces on their own also just commit, a significant percentage of those human rights violations, even, in their uniforms. So, this case that happened in Ayotzinapa has just become completely emblematic of all of this that's been going on over the last 8 years, in Mexico. And, 43 students were disappeared. These are poor rural poor rural school teachers. They're training to be school teachers. And, this happened in Guerrero State. They're from a town called Ayotzinapa. So people, they become, this case of their disappearance on September 26th, this past September 26th has become, symbolic of, all of these, countless, human rights violations that have occurred.
Why would someone shoot, student teachers?
It clearly is, there was political motivation behind it. I think that the school definitely has, a very radical analysis, which is completely understandable given the fact that, Mexico does not fund does not give funding to the education of its people. And that's basically what they were protesting. They were protesting that exact, the lack of funding for schools, for them to be able to, these are poor, mostly indigenous, families that send these kids to this school, and it's just for them to even get to that school, they've already defied the odds, because of the lack of, resources provided to them, to be able to obtain an education. So they were protesting for there to be even, for there to be just adequate funding of the school that keeps on, diminishing and diminishing. During this protest, the police apprehended them and disappeared them, and the Mexican military was also involved.
I understand that the parents of the students, some will be visiting, Washington, D.C.
That is correct. There'll be a series, the parents of the, of some of the parents and some of the, their attorneys and a few of the students as well, that survived the attack, will be touring through, throughout the U.S. This tour will start in, the caravan, it's called the Caravan 43, 4 to 43 students, and that caravan will begin next week in Texas. And there'll be actually several stops in D.C. It's been a little bit complicated, and the dates are still completely being finalized, but we will be hosting, there'll be an event on March 20th. Actually, we'll have a protest, so a week from tomorrow, outside of the OAS, at 9 o'clock in the morning.
That's at 17th and Constitution Avenue?
I, I, sorry, you probably know that better than I do. I don't remember what the address is, but I believe it's right about there.
Arturo, I think we've been joined by another caller. Good morning, caller, if you would give your name.
Kidane, please. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. You know, there was a documentary that I have seen that was done by an American, actually, during the Chavez regime. And the documentary shows that how the right wing or those rich people, how they enjoy their rights over there. You know, they got their own TV 24/7. They were belittling. I mean, all that you can think of, you know. But this guy, I don't know how he's surviving, the guy, the Maduro, or whatever you call him. I don't know how he's surviving with all the kind of things, this right-wing politicians that they do in politicians. Can he survive with this the pressure that he's getting? That's my question.
Well, he was elected by the majority.
Well, I know that one, but that doesn't seem to be respected by the so-called international community these days.
The international community?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, when I mean international community, you know, basically we're talking about yes, no?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, when you talk about the international community, you have to include Cuba, Bolivia, Ecuador.
I agree.
And even the ex-president of Colombia is has said, you know, these sanctions are not called for.
Yeah, I think it's very important to recognize that the rest of Latin America, even the U.S. allies, are forced to have been forced to come into to declare that these sanctions are uncalled for and unnecessary and violate the sovereignty and internal politics of Venezuela. Today, actually, there will be an emergency meeting by UNASUR, which is the Union of South American States. Given the fact that the Organization of American States has been utilized by the U.S. as a it's been controlled by the U.S. For since its inception. Yet at the same time, the U.S. doesn't avail itself to the human rights obligations under the OAS, which is very hypocritical but typical of the U.S. Given that fact, Latin America has gone on, led by Venezuela, led by Hugo Chavez, to create two other organizations that to basically make the OAS obsolete, and that's exactly.
And what are those are what are those organizations?
One is the community. It's called the UNASUR. One of them is UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's CELAC, which would then be all of the South American nations, as well as Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean, and. Both of those organizations have made it very clear, the leadership of those organizations, and also by unanimous declarations, that the sanctions are rejected by Latin America. And I think anybody outside of the U.S. would very quickly recognize how ridiculous the sanctions are with the language that is used, and wouldn't be able to read that with a straight face, what the State Department, what Obama supposedly authored. So let's, you know, again, let's make sure that let's not confuse the United States with the international community, because the U.S., all it is doing is actually isolating itself even more, showing its true colors, that it continues to be an imperialist power that does not respect the democratic will of other nations, and certainly not in Venezuela or Latin America.
Do you, since we're talking about sanctions, what kind of impact? We've seen an impact of sanctions with Cuba, but what kind of impact would sanctions have on Venezuela?
Well, it's tough to see how this is going to go. I think it's going to be an interesting political battle. I think the U.S. has made a miscalculation, because I think there will be, a unified Latin American response to this. Right now we have to see if, you know, to the degree of where these sanctions go. Right now they're only applying them to 7 officials.
Mm.
But obviously the language is very troubling. and the application of the sanctions, you know, is still unknown, and we have to see. I think that's why it's actually very important for those of us here in the United States to actually push back, contact at the very, you know, it's hard to organize and have an effect on U.S. foreign policy. But that's what, you know, but there are organizations like ours, the School of America's Watch, that have been trying to do this for 25 years with, and it's a long-term struggle, right? But there are some short-term measures that we can take, and one of them is contacting members of Congress and asking them to oppose this, and that is obviously ridiculous on its face value. I would also urge people to seek out the Democracy Now! Clip of the State Department press conference where the sanctions were announced, and it's really just Orwellian. And one of the reporters calls out the statements from the State Department where they're just basically lying about what this is all about, and lying about how the U.S. has a long tradition of respecting only constitutional changes of power, which is just a bold-faced lie. Right now, the problem is that these sanctions are part of a coordinated campaign with the Venezuelan domestic opposition, and could lead to you know, the fears are that this could be part of a strategy to topple the government, or if there is any type of violence by the opposition, if the government then reacts with violence, then there would be, again, you know, an increased chance of there being a toppling of government. So I would definitely urge folks to contact the members of Congress.
Can you give the information that if people are interested in the caravan, the parents of Ayotzinapa, or interested in any of the things that we've been talking about, how can they find out more information?
Well, they should definitely go on our website, saw.org. We'll be updating that soon with more of the final.
That's SOAW.org.
Correct.
Okay.
And you know, we'll have a protest on next Friday morning in front of the OAS, but then we'll have a public event the following week. We're still finalizing the dates. Everything's been kind of less. Last minute with the planning of the national caravan, but they either the 24th or the 25th we'll have a joint event on Ayotzinapa and El Salvador, because it'll be the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero. And then April 7th, we're still finding a venue, but April 7th we're gonna have an event which will feature both the parents, some of the parents of the disappeared students from Ayotzinapa, and also parents that have children that were lost to police brutality here in the United States, and kind of also a black brown unity event and also an internationalist event to show that, you know, the state violence is actually connected to, you know, the United States, both in here domestically, and then they're also in a sense importing this model of state violence exporting that. And we're going to hopefully have a good discussion about what it looks like.
We've been talking to Arturo Vizcarra. Arturo, I want to thank you for joining us this morning. Arturo is from the School of the Americas Watch. And that's about it for Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Lucy Murphy, also signing off for Esther Iverum. A special thanks to Arturo Vizcarra for joining us today. And thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella. And thank you so much for listening and calling in.